Exploring with you the six paramitas, we have discussed the paramita of generosity, beautiful capacity of human beings to be generous. In English, there's a saying that love makes the world go round. I suspect that it's more likely that generosity is what makes it go around. And then the paramita of integrity or virtue. And it's maybe somewhat of a religious point of view, opinion, that if you are get to be fully yourself, that you'll be integral, you'll have integrity, you'll have kind of almost like a natural virtue, if you just feel your own sufficiency. And then there's the paramita of patience or acceptance, forbearance, forgiveness. Probably it's hard to do a path like this without a lot of forgiveness. Because who is it who has not made mistakes? And the path is very forgiving. And I think of the, for me, one of the close synonyms for kshanti is trust. To trust the path, to trust the Dharma, to trust the practice. And then the paramita of energy, effort, endeavor, engagement, persistence. Without some effort or some energy, there would be no path. But one of the great mysteries, not a mystery is the right word, but one of the great explorations is all the different variety of effort and energy. In that, hopefully, we find ourselves. That effort and not something that is external to ourselves, but is ourselves. We are the effort we make. More than we have to add effort, oh, I have to make this effort. And, you know, like, I was fine beforehand, but now I've been told to huff and puff. I have to do this effort thing. But rather, effort is who we are. That's just. And then today we come to the paramita of samadhi. And I choose the word samadhi, the Sanskrit word, intentionally to avoid using the English word, the C word. And samadhi is, I hope for all of you, one day or other, someday, that you'll come to have a lot of respect and maybe even reverence and awe for samadhi, for the human capacity for samadhi, for the possibility, for your capacity. In Hinduism, the word samadhi has sometimes a different meaning than in Buddhism. Sometimes it's almost, in Hinduism, synonymous with nirvana. So it kind of elevates its status. But to approach samadhi, maybe as you would approach a sacred object. You know, you go to a sacred temple, sacred spot, and you might enter into it with a certain kind of respect, care, maybe awe, reverence. Maybe reverence is the word I'm looking for. Reverence for samadhi. And if you're kind of like a secular type who doesn't like this religious stuff, maybe there's another example that would work. Kind of with a care, respect, reverence that you might use to enter a preschool class when they're all napping. That is a special time. That is, you don't want to disturb that. It's kind of like that. If you're incapable of awe, go into a preschool class when there's 30 kids napping. But to approach it with some kind of reverence. And I say that because too many times people approach the practice, the experience of samadhi, with acquisitiveness, with greed, with a lot of ego and identification, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get concentrated, I'm going to apply myself, I have to get concentrated, I have to get more concentrated than the next person. And then, you know, in the Theravada tradition, Zen is free of this to some degree, the having these, you know, different levels of concentration. In the Theravada tradition, we have levels. So that's great for measuring yourself. And have I gotten to the first jhana yet? Because you're only really a good meditator, right? You only succeed if you can get something and you have to show for it. And Zen, you don't get to show it anything. And I would never have survived in Theravada Buddha and Vipassana as a new student. Zen was so helped me so well and supported me so well in practice because I wasn't burdened with these ideas of first and second and third level of concentration and this and that. In fact, I was quite blessed, I felt, in my early years of Zen, that I didn't even know I was supposed to get concentrated. That saved me a lot of grief. And it allowed me to settle into samadhi, settle into some state of sufficiency and wholeness. That sometimes it's hard when you have a map and you have, like, let's do these things. And so this acquisitiveness and then disappointment and expectation that comes with it. But if we approach samadhi with reverence, then I think we kind of are a little bit saved from all this, all the unhealthy ways of approaching it. Couple of stories of young, these kind of stories. I apologize to the young men here, but you know how you'll recover. You know, these stories are usually made up of young idealistic men. And the first one, a well-to-do, aristocratic, very competent and capable idealistic young man, succeeded in everything he could do. Maybe that's why he went to the monastery, because he succeeded in everything and he saw maybe this, none of it really satisfied him. And so he came to the abbot and he said, if I stay here and practice in the monastery, how long until I get enlightened? And the abbot said, oh, about 10 years. And he said, yes, but if I'm capable and I can really apply myself, and if I really work hard at it, how long will it take? Oh, in that case, it'll take 20. And then the other story, again, these are maybe archetypes. The same kind of young, confident aristocrat, used to getting whatever he wanted, came to the monastery, and the abbot said, why are you here? Well, I'm here to be a monk. Why? Because I want to attain the full power and glory of the Dharma. The abbot said, oh, okay. And then later in the day, and you know, a poor farmer's son, of course it has to be that way, right? Came to the monastery and to join the order, and the abbot said, why are you here? And the farmer's son said, to see the Dharma in the food I eat, the water I drink, in the eyes and faces of the people I encounter. That's why I'm here. And the abbot said, oh. And so the first one was happy to get to the monastery, be there, and as soon as he had some free time, like, he was going to go for it. He was there for the full power and glory of the Dharma, and he wasn't going to waste any time diddling around. So he went into the meditation hall, sat down. He certainly was capable and confident, strong mind, and sat down, and sure enough, could get concentrated pretty quickly and could taste the fruit and the delight and the beautiful, this is it, I can do it, I'll just, he was going to go for it. And he went for it, and concentration got stronger and stronger until, and finally, poof, he burst into flames. And within a few seconds, all that was left was a little bit of ash on his zafu. He got what he wanted. But the farmer's son, he just went about the schedule and the activities, content to find the Dharma, find the truth in the pots that he washed, in the sanitizer door he opened and closed, the floors he mopped, the toilets he cleaned, people who stood in front of him and behind him in line. And he settled in short order, in relatively quick time, he became enlightened. So these are, you know, kind of teaching stories to make a point. But this idea that to be acquisitive, to be greedy, to be pushy, to be, have expectations, to try so hard to get something, we do have someone who cleans the meditation hall every day. So if all you're left is ash, know that we'll clean it up soon enough. So to approach, but it's a beauty, you know, it's an important thing, the samadhi thing. It's samadhi. So the reason I like using the word samadhi here rather than the C word is that many people have association with concentration, which is different than, I think, what samadhi is. Some people, when they hear the word concentration or concentrate, think of being willful. And kind of having kind of a laser focus, kind of bearing down or kind of locking in or staying, you know, they talk sometimes of a one-pointedness. So that's, I just choose, at that point, just really stay there and kind of in a forceful way. And, but the samadhi doesn't refer to an activity, a mental act of concentration, mental act of concentrating. It refers to a state of concentration. It's a state of being that arises when we're composed, when we're collected, when there's a unification of all our faculties and who we are, when we feel complete, we're not scattered and fragmented. And often the ordinary mind, many times, is fragmented. We're kind of spinning or going this way and that way. And it's, we have many different aspects of our being, many different parts of ourselves that are operating kind of simultaneously, but they can be operating in different directions. So, for example, I could sit down to meditate and my heart is still racing from a difficult conversation I had earlier in the day. My stomach is hungry. My intention is to stay focused on the breath. My thoughts are thinking about the project I have to do, finish by tomorrow. My eyes are heavy from the lack of sleep that I had. And that's just beginning, you know. So all these different currents, all these different momentums of our life, kind of all kind of spinning and going. And so it's, so samadhi is when all the different faculties we have come together and work for the same purpose, are working in harmony, so that our body is kind of in harmony with our intention. Our emotional life is in harmony with our intention. Our thoughts are in harmony, working together, aligned. I love the word that Paul used of aligned. They're all aligned together, they're collected. So so it's a gathering together, a collecting, or unifying, or aligning of all the faculties we have. So they're all operating at the same time for the same purpose. So we're not fragmented and broken up. And to have, to be unified in that way, to be whole in that way, not fragmented, is a great thing. It's good to feel whole and not scattered and fragmented. And it's easy to be fragmented. Some people have tremendous divisions inside of them. Sometimes we're at war, one side against another side. We don't like parts of ourselves. And sometimes the good part is angry with the bad part's rebelling against the good part, but the villain is the good part because of the way it's kind of like, you bad person. You know, so, but when we're divided that way, we're not unified. And a big part of the task is for these different sides of ourselves to come together, to work together, to be friends, to hold hands, to not see each other as being opposed. And so everything working together. So this is so it's more than just a simple focus of the mind. It's a state that we enter into. The way that in the teachings of the Buddha, the verbs connected to samadhi are to enter into and abide. To enter into and dwell in. It's the word abide. And enter into, again, if you go along with my kind of analogy, it's kind of like entering the temple, entering this place of reverence. And then we abide there, we rest there. And one kind of image I've had for this kind of aligning of all the different parts of ourselves is when I was in, I think it was like second or third grade, this is what I remember, maybe you did it also. You had these little red magnets, U magnets, back then, and you took them into the sandbox at school, and you kind of pulled it along the sand in one direction over and over again, and the little iron filaments that's in the sand would line up. And we could do it, and you could line up kind of along the magnetic line you're doing it. So we do some like, we stay with the breath, come back and stay with the breath. And things begin to line up, align, gather together, join. And one way that it does this, and this is one of the important things to understand about any meditation practice, is it's important to understand that meditation practice can work when it doesn't work. And you save yourself a lot of grief if you understand how it works when it's not working. In fact, it might work better when it doesn't work. So it works when it works. Say that you're trying to get concentrated, so you got concentrated. Say you're trying to stay with the breath, and you're able to stay with it. Great. But if it doesn't work, if you don't get concentrated, you can't stay with the breath, then the effort to stay with the breath or stay focused highlights in relief that you're having a difficult time doing that. And then you can look at, what is that difficulty? What's going on? What's happening that it's hard to get concentrated, or hard to stay focused? And that's the mindfulness, that's the noticing, that's turning to look, what's actually happening here? And if you turn to look at what's happening, then it's working. Then that's all you need to do. You don't need to get concentrated. You need to meet what's really happening, what's really going on. So the analogy I like for this is that of a still, quiet mountain stream where the water is very clear and kind of shallow, and you can see the beautiful rocks glistening in the sunlight through the water. But you can't see that the water is flowing. It looks like it's still water. And then you take a stick and you put it into the water vertically, and then you see a wake getting formed on the edge of the stick. And there's a current, the water is flowing. And sometimes we need an equivalent of a reference stick like that, that help us see the currents, the momentum of our life. And the effort to stay on the breath, for example, is the stick. And so you don't have to succeed at staying with the breath, just need to have the attempt to stay with the breath help you to see more clearly what you wouldn't have seen. You see how much you're caught in your thoughts and your feelings and involved in all that. It's common for people then to feel discouraged because they think they're supposed to be staying with the breath. And that's, you know, if that's what you think you're supposed to do, then it makes some sense to get discouraged. But, you know, you don't have to approach practice that way. It's possible to, rather than stay with the breath, do the best you can, but then use that as the reference point. So you see more clearly the momentum, the movements you have, how you're caught in other things and concerns that you might not have noticed unless you try to stay with the breath. That makes some sense? So that way, it works even better when it doesn't work. Isn't that a relief? Some people saying no. Oh well, sorry. So samadhi. One of the things that, another, I think, nice approach for samadhi. One of the functions of samadhi is not for its own sake, but rather it's to help create the clarity of mind that helps us to do two things: to see clearly and to be in a state that helps transformation. So to see clearly, having a concentrated mind is kind of like having a tripod that you have a telescope on. If you try to hold the telescope without a tripod and look at the moon, it's going to wobble and you can't really see. But if you put it on the telescope on a tripod, then it's stable and you can see clearly. So to create stability in the mind, stability in our being, then helps us to see more clearly what's really happening here, to see more deeply what's really happening here, that you can't see if we're running around in our thoughts and spinning around in our concerns and agitated. So to help the mind become stable and calm, like a calm, still mountain lake where you can see what's in the water. The other function of samadhi is to help the mind become, and this is a quote from the suttas, soft, malleable, and workable. To create a soft mind. Because a hard mind, a rigid mind, can't budge much. We say, you know, that person's really rigid. You know, not going to budge. But if someone say, what we say is someone is flexible or fluid or, you know, then we feel, you know, they can kind of adapt themselves to situations. So the mind can get quite brittle and hard, inflexible. And so part of the function of samadhi is to help soften the mind, soften the heart. And that's a very important thing to remember, because you don't create a soft mind by practicing hard. Bear down, grit my teeth. Has a lot to do, samadhi has a lot to do with learning to relax. To have a relaxed mind. In fact, some teachers emphasize that a big part of what samadhi involves is letting go, learning to let go. Let go of the hardness, let go of the clinging and the holding. So in this kind of reverent approach to samadhi, I think it's useful not to think that samadhi is something that you do, that you get yourself samadhied, concentrated. It's up to you. But I approach it as I create the conditions for samadhi, and when the conditions are right, samadhi will occur. But I feel like samadhi is a gift that comes. It's not something that I make happen. And as a gift, it feels delightful. Wow. But what I do is put in place the conditions for it. And what's really nice about this list of the six paramitas is that, as with many of these lists in Buddhism, they can also be understood as somewhat sequential, in the sense that one is a good foundation for the next. And it's a tradition that generosity is a good foundation for cultivating virtue. Generosity and virtue together are good foundations for cultivating patience or trust. Those three together are great foundations for effort. Effort feels very different if there's a lot of trust than if there's mistrust. And then all those four together, generosity and integrity, trust, acceptance, effort, are all needed as conditions for samadhi. And then all those together with samadhi is a condition for wisdom, for the arising of wisdom, which is a topic for tomorrow. Sometimes when people are looking for samadhi, they do look in the wrong place. They look for this one-pointedness of mind. And I think a more useful place to find it and feel it is kind of a wide, like a bubble, like a wide flow, a field of presence that builds up. So sometimes it's closely connected to having an expansive mind, open mind, heart. It's closely connected to being receptive through all our pores, present throughout our pores, all the pores open, kind of feeling. And what samadhi is, these states, there are different states. It's not necessary to put the, you know, into different, there's different lists of states, different ways of understanding the states, but there are different, qualitatively different kind of ways in which these states of samadhi are experienced, which I find helpful to know, because that way we don't have to get locked in, thinking it has to be one way. But one of the things that characterizes both getting into samadhi, entering samadhi, and staying there has to do with letting go. And to know that helps us not to be so caught up in the effort part of it all, like forceful effort, willful effort. It's also like, let go, open up, relax. So the way the ancient texts talk about entering samadhi, they say it's first done by letting go of what's called the five hindrances. And the first two hindrances, desire and ill will, have a lot to do, it makes sense to let go of those, not because of judging the states themselves, but because when there's desire and ill will, the mind is preoccupied with an object of attention, something we want, something we don't want. And if it's preoccupied, we can't settle deeply. So there has to be a letting go of the constant movement, for many people, the constant movement of objectification, of living in the world out there, of wanting and not wanting, and hoping and not hoping, and kind of anytime the mind is kind of directed beyond, the heart's directed outside of itself. What I want tomorrow, or what I want later, or what I don't want, my fantasies, and what should have happened and shouldn't happen. And so it's not so much we have to let go of desire and aversion, but we need to let go of the mind's movement to focus beyond itself, to be narrowed into some particular concern. We lose ourselves in those particular concerns. So let go of that. So one thing I like to say is when you're caught up in a desire, don't let go of the desire, but turn your attention 180 degrees around and feel what it's like to have desire. You don't have to worry about what you're desiring about. It could be anything, even something wonderful. But just turn around 180 degrees and what's a subjective experience like of desiring? And then you enter into a whole different universe. Then you're no longer involved in what you want, but what it's like to be a person who wants. Then you're closer, you're more intimate, you're here with yourself. This is where the practice is found. This is where the path opens up. Or if you feel ill will, anger, aversion, and turn the attention 180 degrees around away from what the thing that you have aversion towards, to feel what's happening here. What it's like to have these feelings of anger or aversion. And if you happen to have aversion towards yourself, how do you do that turning then? You still can do it exactly the same way, because you're always going to have aversion to some idea of who you are, and you've objectified yourself. You've made yourself into a thing if you have aversion towards yourself. So you can kind of turn the attention around to feel more intimately, closer in. What's it like to be aversive? What's that feel like? So there's a kind of letting go of where we direct the attention. We don't necessarily have to let go of the desire. But then if we let go of where it's directed, then we start settling into here. The settling here. And so we abandon these things. We let go of desire and aversion. They no longer have our grip. They no longer fragment us, preoccupy us. And that's if there's going to enter into samadhi, that's required. And then, when we're no longer preoccupied out there with things and ideas, and we can enter into the subjective world of being settled here, then the word that I like to use to translate samadhi is not concentration, but is composure, to be composed. And a little bit it's kind of nice, because the Sanskrit roots of the word samadhi, sam means with, and di of samadhi means to pose or to stand. And so that comes, and that's the same roots for our English word composure, with and pose, right? So to be composed, and for me, to be composed has a very different feeling than the English word to concentrate. So what happens, how do you practice if instead of concentrating on your breath, you compose yourself on the breath? You know, so for me, the word composure is something that's holistic, that includes much more of me than a simple functioning of attention. So I compose myself, it's partly physical. You might even actually change your posture to compose yourself. You know, if you're sitting in a chair all slumped over and someone tells you, compose yourself. Hopefully they say it in the most compassionate way possible. The wisest way possible. And chances are, if you take that as good advice, you would probably kind of sit up a little bit, change your posture and kind of be balanced in a balanced posture. So how do you find your balance with what's happening? How do you compose yourself on your breathing? And then not just physically, but how about emotionally? So whatever you're feeling emotionally, can you somehow integrate it in so it's there holding the breath, or part of the breath, or the breath holding it? And then the mind also, this poor little mind of us, overworked mind. Some people don't discover how exhausted their mind is until they come on retreat. You know, it's been working hard. But for me, the idea of composing the mind on the breath, composing the mind and what I'm focusing on, has a kind of feeling of breath and openness and settledness. And kind of, for me, I don't know if it works for you, but kind of an enveloped feeling. I'm going to envelop my attention around this. I'm going to hold it as opposed to poke at it with my prod of concentration. So to compose, to settle, to gather together, to unify. And then, of course, because we are often kind of have all these other important concerns, issues, it's not easy to get composed. And there are other things that come in, feelings and thoughts and concerns, and all kinds of things will come in that makes it difficult to get focused, composed, settled. It's best not to take any of those as a mistake. Right on time. Those things also. Can you turn towards those and compose yourself on those? Let those be the subject of being composed, rather than resisting it or upset with it or attacking it or trying to fix it, what happens if you turn towards whatever is happening and compose yourself around it, settle yourself into it? So if you're angry, find where the anger is and compose yourself around that experience of anger. Settle yourself on it. Don't be fighting it or resisting it, but don't believe it. Compose yourself. Settle. If you have a lot of thoughts, there's an art to finding what it's like, the experience of thinking. What's the process of thinking feel like? And then compose yourself on that thinking muscle. Settle yourself there. So you're not focused on what you're thinking about, but you're focused on how you're holding it. And slowly, over time, what happens is that we begin having more and more choice about how we relate to whatever is going on. Rather than being the victims of what the mind wants to do and what it's doing, and then relating to whatever is happening through our greed, our aversion, our fear, our doubts, and doing it because that's what the mind does, and we're just kind of going along for the ride. We start having more choice about how attention is used. And we have more choice to begin holding our experience, holding it in the embrace of samadhi, hold it in the embrace of composure, holding it there, settling, letting it settle into your... I love the image of two cupped hands that hold our experience. So it might be a difficult experience you're having. And imagine your attention, your awareness, like two hands that come from underneath and just holds it there. So it can settle. It can get composed. And as you do this, then there, from time to time, the mind will start getting quiet. And one of the characteristics of samadhi is a quiet mind. Our thinking gets thinner and thinner. It doesn't necessarily go away, but it doesn't have as much force or weight or solidity. It gets thinner and thinner, like it moves from being a granite wall to a gauze wall to a just little filaments. Just good. And that was very helpful for me to understand, because I used to, for a long time, was expecting to be, I would find the button, the switch, the thinking switch. If I could just find that switch, I would just turn it all off. As it was on or off, that was the options. And then I learned, no, that's not how it works. It slowly begins to weaken and quiet and thin out. And so this thinning, quieting, composing, feeling of sufficiency, a willingness just to be here. A fullness of intimacy, fullness of being connected to here, to this body, this mind, that kind of a fullness that where the concerns we have in our mind begin to pale in significance, pale in importance. They're still there, maybe they're important in their own domain, but they're not, you know, they kind of begin to not seem that significant anymore. Because here becomes significant. The aliveness, the fullness, the subtleness, here. can start becoming soft, softer and flexible, receptive, happy. Part of the function of samadhi is so we can be happy, certain joy. And that joy, relaxation, softness, then we can hear the Dharma, we can see the Dharma, we can feel the Dharma, smell the Dharma in ways that can help be transformative. And the particular transformation that I think is most useful is a transformation where we put down what we cling to. We let up on what we're holding on to so tightly. And so the training in the paramitas is all a training in helping us to let go of what we cling to and hold on to so tightly. Generosity, obviously, letting go. Virtue, for some people, means letting go of a lot that we hold on to. Unethical behavior usually involves a lot of clinging. Kshanti, patience, that also is a kind of letting go of what we're clinging to or want. Effort, healthy, integrated effort is kind of the effort to let go, to be connected in a whole way. And then samadhi, and letting go into our wholeness, letting go into being here. And the final thing I'll say is that one of the great things about Mahayana Buddhism, you know, Theravada Buddhism has these like four samadhis or eight samadhis, dates. The Mahayana Buddhism figured out how to have millions of samadhis. There are sutras that just go on and on listing all the samadhis. It's great. Because the place for your samadhi is whatever is happening for you at the moment. Please don't be comparing yourself to states of samadhi and thinking you have to measure up to them or attain them. There's the samadhi of this moment, of meeting this thing, being here with composing, with whatever it might be. But then as you, with time, from time to time, if you get settled and composed and quiet and soft, settled, feeling the joy of concentration, it's helpful to know that that's part of the practice also, and to appreciate that, to make room for it. Let that support you in letting go further, settling further. And if you're not there, you're exactly where you're supposed to be. You're always exactly where you need to be. And how do you meet that? So let's, some of you are sitting quietly, Let's take a few moments to settle and to compose yourself. If you take whatever is happening to you right now, wherever you're at, as your samadhi, how do you compose yourself on it? Settle into it. Relax into this state.